Raleigh and Changi seized the loops of rope on the Zodiac's side to pull themselves up, and the moment they were on board, Robert gunned the Evinrude, and they shot away from the foundering vessel. The splashing and cries of distress faded behind them as Robert turned the Zodiac back towards the shore. The long, deserted stretch of Woodstock Beach showed as a pale line of sand in the starlight ahead. Raleigh stripped off his faceplate and leaned solicitously over the figure on the deck. He lifted him into a sitting position, and Moses Garmer coughed painfully. "I see you, my uncle," Raleigh said softly. "Raleigh!" Moses' voice was rough with the salt water he had swallowed. "Is it you, Raleigh?" "We will be ashore in 10 minutes, my uncle." Raleigh tucked one of the thermal blankets around Moses' shoulders. "All of the plans for your escape have been carefully laid. Everything is ready for you, my uncle. Soon now you will be where nobody can touch you." Robert ran the rubber inflatable in through the surf at full throttle, and they shot up the sand, clear of the water. As they came to a standstill, they lifted Moses Garmer out of the Zodiac and ran with him up the beach, carrying him between them so his chained feet barely touched the sand. There was a small closed van parked amongst the dunes, and Raleigh jerked the rear doors open, and they lifted Moses into the back and laid him on the mattress that covered the floorboards. Changi jumped in beside him, and Raleigh slammed the rear doors closed. Robert would take the Zodiac out and sink it. Raleigh stripped off the jacket of his wetsuit. The key to the van was on a loop of nylon line around his neck. He opened the driver's door and slid behind the wheel. The van was facing back along the track. The track joined the road that skirted the industrial area of Pardon Island, and Raleigh drove sedately along it towards the black township of Lunga. The official Cape Town residence of the Minister of Police was one of those clustered around the Prime Minister's residence at Groote Schuur. The cumbersome physical division of the legislative and executive arms of government between the cities of Cape Town and Pretoria made for costly duplications. During the annual session of Parliament in Cape Town, all the ministers and the entire diplomatic corps were forced to move down from Pretoria, 1,000 miles to the north, and official residences had to be maintained in both cities at enormous expense. Manfred de la Rey's ministerial residence was an elegant Edwardian mansion set in acres of its own private lawns and gardens. As Rolf Stunder parked his shabby little second-hand Morris in front of this imposing building, it seemed oddly out of place. Sarah Stunder had been desperately trying to arrange a private meeting with Manfred ever since her son had been convicted and sentenced to death. However, Manfred had been in Pretoria, or at his ranch in the Free State, or opening a memorial to the women who had died in the British concentration camps during the Boer War, or addressing the National Party caucus, and therefore unable to see her. Sarah had persisted, telephoning his office at Parliament every day, telephoning Heidi at home and pleading with her, until at last Manfred had agreed to see her at 7 o'clock in the morning before he left for Parliament. Sarah and Rolf had driven in the Morris from Stellenbosch, leaving before sunup so as not to be late for the appointment. When the coloured butler showed them through to the dining room, Manfred and Heidi were seated at the breakfast table. Heidi sprang up and came to kiss Sarah's cheek.
"I'm sorry we have not seen you for so long, Sari."
"Yes," Sarah agreed bitterly.
"I also am sorry. But as you explained to me, money has been too busy for us."
Manfred stood up from the head of the table. He was in his shirt sleeves, and the linen table napkin was tucked into the top of his dark suit trousers.
"Rolf," he smiled, and they shook hands like old friends. "Thank you for agreeing to see us, Marnie," Rolf said humbly. "I know how busy you are these days."
The years had not been kind to Rolf Stunder. He had greyed and shrunk, and Manfred felt a secret satisfaction as he studied him.
Sit down, Rolf." Manfred led him to a place at the breakfast table. "Heidi has ordered breakfast for you. Will you start with porridge?"
He seated Rolf and then reluctantly turned back to Sarah. She was still standing beside Heidi.
"Hello, Sari," he said.
She had been such a pretty little thing. They had grown from childhood together.
There were still the remains of that girlhood beauty in her eyes and the shape of her face. The memory of the love they had once shared rushed back to him, and he felt the sweet nostalgic yearning for his youth. He had a vivid image of her lying naked on a bed of pine needles in the forest high up on the slopes of the Hottentots Holland Mountains on the day that they had become lovers. He searched in his heart for a vestige of what he had felt for her then, but he found none. Any love that once had flowered between them had been smothered by the knowledge of her treachery. For more than 2 decades he had delayed his revenge, contenting himself with slowly undermining and reducing this woman to her present state, waiting for exactly the right moment to extract the final retribution. It had come, and he savored the moment. "Hello, Marnie," she whispered, and she thought, "He has been so cruel. He has filled my life with pain that has been difficult to bear. Now all I ask from him is my son's life. Surely he will not deny me that also." "So, why have you come to see me?" Marnie asked, and Heidi led Sarah to a seat at the table. She took the silver teapot from the coloured servant and told him, "Thank you, Gamut, you can leave us now. Please close the door." And she poured steaming coffee into Sarah's cup. "Yes, Sarah," she agreed. "Tell us why you have come to see us."
"You know why I've come to see you," Sarah said. "It's Corbus."
A deathly stillness held them all over the slow passage of the seconds. And then Manfred sighed.
"Ja," he said. "Corbus. Why do you come to me about Corbus?"
"I want you to help him, Marnie."
"Corbus has been tried and convicted of a sickening act of senseless brutality," Manfred said slowly. "The highest court in the land has decreed that he must die on the gallows. How can I help Corbus?"
"The same way you helped that black terrorist, Moses Gama." Sarah was pale, and the coffee cup clattered as she tried to set it down on the saucer.
"You saved his life. Now save the life of my son."
"The state president exercised leniency in Gama's case."
"No, Marnie," Sarah interrupted. "It was you that changed it. I know. You have the power to save Corbus."
"No," he shook his head. "I haven't got that sort of power. Corbus is a murderer, the worst kind of killer, one without compassion or remorse. I cannot help him."
"You can. I know you can, Marnie. Please, please, I beg of you, save my son."
"I cannot," Manfred's expression set. His mouth hardened into a straight, unrelenting line.
"I will not." "You must, Marnie. You have no choice. You must save him."
"Why do you say that?" He was becoming angry. "There is nothing I must do."
"You must save him, Marnie, because he is your son also. He is the child of our love, Marnie. You have no choice. You must save him."
Manfred sprang to his feet and placed his hand protectively on Heidi's shoulder.
"You come into my house and insult me and my wife?"
His voice shook with the force of his anger.
"You come here with wild stories and accusations?"
Rolf Stunder had sat quietly through it all, but now he lifted his head and spoke softly.
"It's true, Marnie. Every word she tells you is true. I knew she was carrying your child when I married her. She told me, frankly, you had deserted her. You had married Heidi. And I loved her."
"You know it is true," Sarah whispered. "You've always known, Marnie. You cannot have looked into Corbus's eyes without knowing. Both your sons have your yellow eyes, Marnie. Lothar and Corbus. Both of them. You know he is your son."
Manfred sank back onto his chair. In the silence, Heidi reached across and deliberately took his hand. That reassuring touch seemed to rally him.
"Even if that were true, there is nothing I would do. No matter whose son he is, justice must run its course. A life for a life. He must pay the penalty for his deed. Marnie, please, you must help us."
Sarah was weeping now, and the tears at last spilled down her pale cheeks. She tried to throw herself at Manfred's feet, but Rolf caught her and held her. She struggled weakly in his arms, but he held her and looked at Manfred.
"In the name of our friendship, Marnie, everything we have done and shared. Won't you help us? He pleaded. I am sorry for you, Rolf. Manfred stood up again. You must take your wife home now.
Rolf drew Sara gently towards the door. But before they reached it, Sara pulled out of his hands and faced Manfred again.
Why? She cried in anguish. I know you can. Why will you not help us?
Because of you, White Sword failed, he said softly. That is why I will not help you.
She was struck dumb by the words, and Manfred turned to Rolf.
Take her away now, he ordered. I have finished with her at last.
During the long journey back to Stellenbosch, Sara huddled in the passenger seat and sobbed brokenly. Only when Rolf parked the Morris outside their cottage did she straighten up, and her voice and her face were ruined with grief.
I hate him, she repeated. Oh, God, how I hate him.
I spoke to David Abrams this morning, Isabella said, leaning forward in the saddle to pat the mare's neck so that her father couldn't see her face. He offered me a job at the Johannesburg office.
Correction, said Shaza. You telephoned David and told him that Johannesburg needed a PRO at a salary of $2,000 a month, plus dress allowance, plus 5-day week, and a company car. And I believe you even stipulated the make. A Porsche 911, wasn't it? David called me the minute you hung up.
Oh, Daddy, don't be so technical.
Isabella tossed her head defiantly. You wouldn't want me to dress in rags and starve up there, would you? What I would want is for you to stay here where I can keep an eye on you. Shaza felt the leaden weight of impending loss in his chest as he looked at her. She was the spice of his life, and she had only been back from London a month or so. Now she wanted to be off again. His instinct was to fight to keep her, but Santon had advised, let them go gently, and there is a chance they will come back to you.
It isn't Siberia or the Outer Hebrides, Daddy. Oh, do be practical. It's just up the road.
1,000 miles up the road, Shaza agreed, and much closer to the rugby stadium at Loftus-Versfeld.
I don't know what you mean.
It was very seldom Shaza could catch her off balance, and vindictively he relished her agitation.
Rugby football, he explained. Great sweaty oafs beating their bony heads together.
She recovered splendidly.
Pater, if this has anything to do with Lothar de Lerae, I would just like to point out that he is one of the greatest athletes of our time and the youngest brigadier in the history of the police force, and that he means absolutely nothing to me at all.
Your indifference is monumental. I am greatly relieved.
Does that mean I can accept David's job offer?
Shaza sighed, and the loneliness descended upon him like a winter's evening.
How can I stop you, Bella?
She let out a triumphant squeal and leaned out of the saddle to wrap those long, tanned arms around his neck, and Shaza's stallion danced under him with aristocratic affront. Isabella chattered merrily all the way back to the chateau.
One thing I forgot to mention to David was a housing allowance. Flats are so awfully expensive in Joey's. I couldn't find anything suitable on the pittance he's paying me.
Shaza shook his head with admiration.
The grooms were waiting in the kitchen yard to take the horses, and still in their jodhpurs and riding boots, they went through to the breakfast room, with Isabella hanging lovingly on her father's arm.
Santon was at the sideboard, helping herself to scrambled eggs from the chafing dish. She was still in her gardening clothes and had been amongst her roses since dawn. Now she looked at Isabella inquiringly, and Isabella gave her a happy wink.
Damn it, Shaza intercepted the exchange. I've been set up. It's a conspiracy.
Of course I told Nana first, Isabella hugged his arm. I always start at the top.
When she was little, I always threatened to hand her over to a policeman if she were naughty, Santon said complacently, as she carried her plate to the breakfast table. I hope this policeman can cope with her.
He's not a policeman, Isabella protested. He's a brigadier. Shaza ladled eggs and fried tomato onto his plate and went to his place at the head of the table. The morning paper was folded neatly on his side plate, and he shook it open at the front page as he sat down. The main news was the proposed meeting between the British Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, and Ian Smith to settle the Rhodesian issue. Now he saw that the suggested venue was a British warship at sea. Israel and Jordan were still disputing the Hebron Valley, and closer to home the Robben Island ferry had capsized during the night with the certain loss of at least two lives, while eight others were missing. The telephone on the sideboard rang, and Santon looked up from buttering her toast.
"That will be Gary," she said. "He rang twice while you were out riding."
"It's only 8 o'clock in the morning," Charles protested, but he went to answer the telephone. "Hello, Gary, where are you?" Gary sounded surprised. "At the office, of course. Or what's the problem?" "Swimming pools," Gary answered. "I have a chance to get the franchise for a new process of making cheap swimming pools. It's called Gunite. Holly and I saw it when we were on honeymoon in the States." "Good Lord, only the very rich can afford private swimming pools," Shaza protested. "Everybody will buy my swimming pools. Every home in the country will have one by the time I'm finished." Gary's enthusiasm was infectious. "It works, Pater, I've seen it, and the figures add up perfectly. Only trouble is, I have to give an answer by noon today. Someone else is interested."
"How much?" Shaza asked.
$4 million initially. That's for the franchise and plant. Another $4 million over 2 years for running costs. Then we'll be into profit."
"All right," Shaza said. "Go ahead."
"Thanks, Pater. Thanks for trusting me."
"Well, you haven't let me down yet.
How is Holly?"
"Oh, she's fine. She's right here with me."
"At the office at 8 o'clock in the morning?" Shaza laughed.
"Of course."
Again Gary sounded surprised. "We're a team. The swimming pools were her idea."
"Give her my love," Shaza said, and hung up.
As he went back to his seat, Santon said, "It's the Prime Minister's budget vote this afternoon. I thought I'd drop in."
"It should be interesting," Shaza agreed. "I think Favut is going to make a major policy speech about the country's international position. I have a committee meeting on armaments this morning. But why don't you meet me for lunch? And you can listen to Dr. Henk's speech from the public gallery afterwards. I'll ask Tricia to get you a ticket."
Tricia was waiting for him anxiously when, an hour later, Shaza walked into his parliamentary suite.
"The Minister of Police wants to see you most urgently, Mr. Courtney. He asked me to let him know the moment you arrived. He said he'd come to your office."
"Very well." Shaza glanced at his appointment book on her desk. "I'll let him know I'm here and then get a ticket for my mother for the public gallery this afternoon. Is there anything else?"
"Nothing important."
Tricia picked up the in-house telephone to ring the Minister of Police's office and then paused.
"Oh, there has been a strange woman ringing you this morning. She called 3 times. She wouldn't give her name, and she asked for Squadron Leader Courtney. Funny, isn't it?"
"All right, let me know if she calls again." Shaza was frowning as he went through to his own office. The use of his old Air Force rank was strangely disquieting. He went to his desk and began work on the mail and the memoranda that Tricia had placed on his blotter, but almost immediately the buzzer rang on his intercom.
"Minister de Larrey is here, sir. Ask him to come right in, Tricia."
Shaza rose and went to meet Manfred, but as they shook hands, he could see that Manfred was a worried man.
"Did you read the news report about the sinking of the ferry?"
Manfred did not even return his greeting, but came immediately to the business.
"I noticed it, but didn't read it all."
"Moses Gama was on the boat when it sank," Manfred said.
"Good Lord!"
Shaza glanced involuntarily at the ivory and gold-leaf altar chest which still stood against the wall of his office.
"Is he safe?"
"He's missing," Manfred said.
"He may have drowned, or he may be alive. Either way, we are in a very serious predicament."
"Escaped?" Shaza asked.
"One of the survivors, a prison officer, says there were 2 vessels at the accident scene, a large ship without lights that collided with the ferry, and another smaller craft that arrived seconds after the ferry capsized. In the darkness it was impossible to see any details. It is a distinct possibility that Gama was spirited away."
"If he drowned, we will be accused of murdering him," Shaza said softly, "with disastrous international repercussions.
And if he is at large, we will face the possibility of a popular uprising of the blacks similar to Lunga and Sharpeville."
"What are you going to do?"
Shaza asked.
The entire police force is on full alert. One of our best men, my own son, Lothar, is flying down from the Witwatersrand in an Air Force jet to take charge of the investigation. He will land within the next few minutes. Navy divers are already attempting to salvage the wreckage of the ferry.
For another 10 minutes, they discussed all the implications of the wreck, and then Manfred moved to the door.
I will keep you informed as we get further news.
Shaza followed him into the outer office, and as they passed Trisha's desk, she stood up.
Mr. Courtney, that woman called again while you were with Minister de Larrey.
Manfred and Shaza both paused,
and Trisha went on, She asked for Squadron Leader Courtney again, sir. And when I told her you were in conference, she said she had news for you about White Sword. She said you'd understand.
White Sword? Shaza froze and stared at her. Did she leave a number?
No, sir, but she said that you must meet her at the Cape Town Railway Station at 5:30 this afternoon, Platform 4.
How will I know who she is?
She says she knows you by sight. You are merely to wait on the platform and she will come to you.
Shaza was so preoccupied with the message that he did not notice Manfred de Larrey's reaction to the codename White Sword. All colour had drained from Manfred's craggy features, and his upper lip and jowls were covered by a sheen of perspiration. Without another word, he turned and strode out into the corridor. The name White Sword kept plaguing Shaza all through the Arms Corps meeting. They were discussing the new air-to-ground missiles for the Air Force, but Shaza found it difficult to concentrate. He was plagued by the memory of his grandfather, that good and gentle man whom Shaza had loved and who had been murdered by White Sword. His death had been one of the fiercest tragedies of his young life, and the rage that he had felt at the brutal killing came back to him afresh.
White Sword, he thought. If I can find out who you are, even after all these years, you will pay, and the interest will be more onerous for the times the debt has stood.